The French parliamentary election runoff vote has taken place, and the French president's party is projected to lose its majority. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this has happened, what this means for France, whether Emmanuel Macron has by default now lost his control of his reform agenda, and what kind of power he will wield without a majority in parliament. Worse yet, will a hung parliament now take place and open up a period of political uncertainty in France? Well, to get the latest, first we're going to cross on over and talk to our correspondent Rami Mazari, who joins us from the French capital, Paris. Rami, at this point, the projection is there. When are we going to find out? I think as we speak, the votes are being counted.
Right. These are just really estimates that came out at the top of the hour about 40 minutes ago. But usually France's estimates, because of the way that they put them together, they've always been almost really perfectly accurate. So we can really take these to heart, barring some sort of historically unusual occurrence. What we see here, it's really a bit sort of misleading. Yes, it is it's a slight punishment for Macron. He's looking at 224 seats. He needs 289 to make an absolute majority, so he's fallen pretty far short of that, and he fell under a lot of projections. However, there's two important realities. When you add in, first of all, Macron is a mainstream conservative, and when you add in his coalition with the old mainstream conservatives, the Republican Party, then they're going to have a 53%, an absolute majority. So on any sort of, neoliberal reform, right-wing economic reforms, Macron is talking about, he's certain to institute the world's first one-size-fits-all pension system this fall. He's going to reform the unemployment system. All these right-wing reforms, austerity budgets, I can go on and on. The mainstream conservatives are going to join him in that. So Macron effectively does have a parliamentary majority. That's the first thing. The second thing is that voter abstention is the lowest ever in, the highest ever in French history, because Macron, even when he had an absolute majority, he would bypass parliament regularly for his most important policies, just to avoid public discussion of right-wing austerity-minded rollbacks. So that's the reason why abstention is so high, because the average French person realizes that ever since the European Union got off the ground, really, with the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, national parliaments don't really mean anything. Macron has proven that for 5 years. So we can sit here and talk about, how these numbers break down. But the reality is that even when Macron had an absolute majority and he could do whatever he wanted in parliament, he still bypassed it. So what does this vote really mean? The real democratic winner here, if you're talking about democracy as majority rule, the real winner is abstention, and there's a reason for that, and I just mentioned it.
Okay, thank you for that. Thanks for actually adding that important piece of information there. That's Rami Mazari, correspondent there from Paris. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate.
All right, you got it. Talk to you later. Bye bye.
Joining us is Gilbert Doctorow, who's an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. We also have Mustafa Traore, an academic and political commentator who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. We're going to start with you, Gilbert Doctorow. Welcome. So I was going to ask you about this majority that Macron has lost based on the projections. which is to be confirmed, but usually the French are pretty correct in even their projections. We just spoke to a correspondent who said that's misleading, because even though Macron has won 224 seats, still with his other party, they are going to still have a 53%, the coalition that is, they're going to have a 53% absolute majority. So maybe you could break that open for us. Does he have a majority or not overall?
Well, I wouldn't want to enter into that particular question, because this is not the area of my concentrated interest in French politics. My interest is a bit removed from Europe, from that of the journalist whom you opened the program with, who focused on the domestic implications regarding the neoliberal reform policies.
Okay,
of,
let's
President
start with that
Trump.
Then. Well, if you agree with the fact that he's got the majority, then it just doesn't leave much to ask you, except for the fact that will he then be able to freely go ahead with the reform agenda that he has, which covers a number of areas, but overall?
Let's assume that he can. But the question that France is facing today is much bigger than the question of Macron's domestic reform policy. The question number one, which has taken a lot of Macron's time in the last few weeks, is the Ukraine war. And in that regard, absolutely nothing has changed from the French election that took place today. The majority parties, taking into account both Macron and the traditional centrist parties, together represent a policy that is not opposed by the leaders of the opposition, Mélenchon and his group. They shared the foreign policy perspective of Macron. In fact, according to her remarks, Marine Le Pen was the only opposition in this election, just as she was the only opposition in the presidential election a bit more than a month ago. She is the only one who is speaking about NATO's relevance and about the correctness or incorrectness of the ruling assumption that Russia is to blame for the Ukraine war. In this regard, the issues that have been fought during the presidential and the legislative election, the issue over cost of living, is not being addressed. It's being ignored totally, because the cost of living is a direct function of the sanctions that Macron and other European leaders have imposed on Russia, and which have come back to bite Europe in the tail. So this election is really unimportant with respect to the issues that the French electorate found driving their voting, which is how can you bring down the cost of living. Neither Macron nor Mélenchon are in a position to address those problems.
Okay, we're going to get back to that. We have our other guest joining us now, Mustafa Traoré. Mustafa Traoré, welcome. I'd like to get one issue straight since you're in Paris, and that is the fact that we're looking at the projection that says that Macron has lost, his party has lost its majority in Parliament. However, when you add the coalition, our correspondent from Paris has said they are going to retain the 53% absolute majority. And that's very important for us to set the precedent here as to whether that is indeed accurate, which will then obviously be the platform for Macron to move ahead with his economic reforms. Are we looking at him, when you add the coalition, to have the 53% absolute majority?
Yes, this is accurate. He's right that even if he did not get the majority, he still got the power, and he can start a kind of coalition with the other parties, political parties from the right. So if the left, or if that new coalition of the left, the NUPES, if they had won the elections, if they had got the majority in parliament, things would have been different. But right now, the situation is that, of course, it's obvious that Macron does not have the majority in parliament anymore, but he can still work into a kind of coalition with the other political parties from the right. And if he does so, they will have the majority. So what it tells us that now the decisions that are going to be taken for the country are more are going to be more kind of right-wing ideas and so on.
Okay. Let me now try to put you to a challenge here, Gilbert Doctorow, with the approach that you had when it comes to, not you had, but what you said about Macron and even Mélenchon in terms of the Ukraine war. It's pretty straightforward in, well, can't say straightforward because we're talking about politics, but it's obvious what the impact is on France, along with other European countries and the U.S. and maybe a number of countries around the world. You're looking at inflation, you're looking at food insecurity, you're looking at high energy prices, just some that come off the top of the list. If you're having your people suffer, why are you going ahead with a war that at this point is over 100 days old? And back in May, you had Macron saying, we're going to increase the aid to Ukraine from $1.7 billion to $2 billion. That's not for
yes,
you, for,
more
Mr.
Indeed.
Gilbert Doctorow. Okay. Sorry, I'll come back to you on that, Mustafa okay. Traoré.
No problem.
Well, you were asking about the policies of Macron with respect to Ukraine, which are exactly the same policies that Mélenchon has just set out in the last few weeks. And I think about something else. The pain that Europe is feeling and that France is feeling from the blowback, from the boomerang effect of sanctions on Russia hasn't really begun in earnest. We are still at the start of the summer. Energy costs are only reflected in the price of petrol at the stations, at the fuel stations, when people fill up their tanks. That is painful. Just remember that the entire yellow vest movement was all about the cost of fuel for cars and for other transport, trucks and so forth. The price of fuel at the stations has risen by close to 80% compared to where it was a year ago. But this doesn't affect the whole population. The whole population will be hit only in September and October when the heating season begins. Fuel oil, mazut, has gone up in price, has almost doubled in price since a year ago. That is an abstract statement. The reality is whether people can afford the price to heat their apartments and their homes. And we will only know that in September and October. So whoever won the legislative election today is not prepared in any way for the likely volatility and political discontent of a large part of the French population when they have to pay their heating bills. In this sense, the question of raising the pension age from 62 to 65 is absolute nonsense. The key points in Mr. Macron's reform policy are irrelevant ahead of the political storm that is likely to hit his government in September and October.
Okay, well, let's see. If you were to take a look, Mustafa Traoré, at what the French did, the French actually were able to cushion their economy quite well in terms of what Macron did, because the numbers spoke in terms of, for example, keeping the inflation low. Not only can they not handle this at this point, even though it's still lower than some other European countries, you're looking at the fact that there is this money that was spent to contain what happened during the COVID-19. There was talk about a 100 billion euro boost that Macron, I'm not too sure, was able to implement all of it, but that did help cushion it. What is he going to do now? As our guest there said, they haven't seen anything yet until the weather gets cold and then it comes time to pay those heating bills, which people are not going to be able to afford.
I think that to understand the reason why France is helping Ukraine in this war, it is because it is more in the interest of France to have Russia defeated in this war. I'm going to try to explain this one. If you think in the short term, you might think, okay, it is not good for France. But in the long term, a victory of Ukraine over Russia is more in the interest of France. What Russia is trying to do right now is to depossess France from all its colonies. And we know that France is nothing without its colonies, its African colonies or former colonies. I call them colonies because if you look at the system that is in place today, they are still colonies. So what Russia is doing right now, Russia, and we see it clearly in Mali, and we know what is planned. So France is going to lose all its colonies. And there is oil, there's lots of resources in the African continents. So what France thought was, okay, if we do not have access to the Russian gas, to Russian oil, we can still have access to what we are going to get from the African continents.
Okay.
But so I think that it is like limiting ourselves if we just look at it as a European issue. We've got to understand that France is nothing without its African colonies. And this is what Russia is trying to destroy today.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I get the feeling, however, Gilbert Doctorow, speaking or listening to the comments that you made, that Macron's drive for reform, whether it's in the pensions to get it to up the or increase the age or for taming inflation and all this, that's going to mean nothing because the country, like many other countries, European countries, are going to face a real economic downturn, even though they're going through the midst of it right now. So none of this is going to matter unless you get some major problems resolved, like the French involvement in the Ukraine war. But that's not just France. So how can Macron think about taming its economy to levels that are that show improvements like inflation without ending the war in Ukraine? I mean, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So what does he have to do here?
Well, the assumption is that France, that Europe, the United States can end the war in Ukraine. The Russians will end the war in Ukraine without any help, thank you very much. And I see that happening in the next 3 to 4 weeks with an attrition rate of 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed daily, with 50 Ukrainian generals and senior killed in one earlier today by the Russian military. It is inconceivable that they will have a workable armed army more than 3 or 4 weeks from now, because their soldiers will either desert, they will give themselves up as prisoners, or they will be killed in the field. And now, to come back to the remark of my fellow panelist about how taming Russia is in France's interest for the long term, but if it were possible to defeat Russia, and I believe it is impossible, because their armed forces are at least the same strength as NATO and possibly better, they have vast reserves of military weaponry that they have not yet used, because this is not a war from Russia's perspective. It's a special military operation. If it were a war, then you can be sure Mr. Schulz and Mr. Macron would not have been able to visit Kiev as they did in the past week, because Kiev wouldn't exist. But let's get to the point. The point is that if Russia could be defeated, then we will have a nuclear war. That is clear as day. The only possible result of a defeat for Russia is a nuclear war in which France will not have a future. It will be erased from the face of the earth. That is simple fact for anyone who knows the military powers of Russia today and the intentions of their leadership, who have said that they cannot imagine a world without Russia. So if the United States pursues a cancel Russia policy, and if France continues to be subservient to the United States in this policy, then we will have a nuclear war, and all of us will be gone, which is very sad.
All right. Well, so much for discussing French politics in terms of just the domestic side of things. Mustafa Traoré, my last question, since we're running out of time. Macron needs to do something about the economy. It needs to address the problems that exist, just like other countries in the EU. We're looking at an economy that has large amounts of debt, and it's obviously increasing so much more with the Ukraine war. What is his biggest challenge and the first step he's going to take in that regard?
I think that Macron has no solution. France is just collapsing. We are just witnessing the collapse of the French nation. And this is one fact. There are lots of contradictions when you look at what Macron is doing and what is in the interest of the country. Condemning Russia, but at the same time trying to get some gas from Russia. So there are lots of contradictions. I think that now we have no solution. The only reason why sometimes we've got the feeling that France is slightly better is because France is exploiting its African colonies.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mustafa Traoré, academic and political commentator. Gilbert Doctor, our pleasure, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitali and the team. It's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
والذين إذا ذكروا بآيات ربهم لم يخروا عليها صما وعميانا
And those who, when reminded of the verses of their Lord, do not fall upon them deaf and blind.
Dear listeners, we have reached the 73rd verse of Surah Al-Furqan. والذين إذا ذكروا بآيات ربهم لَمْ يَخِرُّوا عَلَيْهَا صُمًّا وَعُمْيَانًا And those who, when admonished with the signs of their Lord, do not fall down, thereat deaf and blind. In the previous programs, we have been discussing the different attributes of Ibadur Rahman, the true servants of the Lord, or the slaves of the Beneficent. Acts of worship and having insight are attributes of the servant of the Beneficent. They knowingly follow religion, and this noble verse mentions another attribute of theirs, which is to have an ear that can hear truly, an eye that can see at the time facing with Allah's revelations. This is the 11th attribute of the servants of the Almighty Allah. So the verse says, وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا ذُكِّرُوا بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ, and those who, when admonished with the signs of their Lord, لَمْ يَخِرُوا عَلَيْهَا صُمًّا وَعُمْيَانًا, do not fall down thereat deaf and blind. Certainly it does not refer to the deed of the pagans, because they do not even pay attention to Allah's verses. But this is referring to the hypocrites, or those who are apparently Muslims, but who are blindly and deafly following Allah's verses. So this verse is saying that these servants of the Beneficent do not fall down deaf and blind. They are completely watching and waiting for the commandments of their Lord. But the hypocrites, or apparent Muslims, neither understand the reality of the verses and neither find the depth of the verses. They do not know Allah's purpose, nor they think about it, nor do they practically use it through inspiration in their lives. Of course, one cannot pave the path of Allah blindly and deafly. Before anything, an ear that hears and an eye that can see are needed for this journey. One needs an eye that can see inwardly and deeply, and an ear that is sensitive. If we think correctly, we see that the damage of this group who are blind and deaf is not less than the damage of the enemies who knowingly are damaging the foundation of the religion of truth. And this is sometimes more, because they are apparent Muslims, they're hypocrites. But the attribute of the servants of the Beneficent is that they are not deaf and not blind.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this verse was emphasizing the importance of not being deaf and blind. Sometimes you are probably following the signs of your Lord, but you're not correctly listening. You're not deeply seeing. Basically, conscious perception and following of the religion is the main source of resistance and forbearance. And for those who have blind eyes and deaf ears, this can easily deceive them. They can be deviated from the main path by distorting religion. They can be led to paganism and disbelief, and they can be turned against the religion itself. They are tools and somehow puppies in the hands of the foes. They are the best victims the devils are looking for. But only insightful believers who see and listen carefully may remain stable. They are not the ones to become puppies of this and that person. When Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asked about the commentary of this verse, he said, "The purpose is the insightful ones that are not skeptic." So the true servants of the Lord consciously follow the commandments of their Lord, and even if they do not know the reason behind this and that order and commandment, they know that it is good for themselves, both in this world and the other. And this means that they're not blind, even though they might not know some of the reasons behind some of the orders of their Lord. And this is the heart of servitude. This is the meaning of servitude. That is why they're called Ibadur Rahman, the servants of the Beneficent. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Demonstrators gathered from around France to demand the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner. George Ibrahim Abdullah, who was known as the Arab Nelson Mandela, has been imprisoned for more than 38 years and has become a beloved hero celebrated around the world.
In 1982, once again, Israel was invading Lebanon. Abdullah's resistance group claimed responsibility for the death of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris.
Abdullah has been eligible for parole since 1999. He refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and while some say that's a reason he hasn't been released, most believe it's due to political pressure from Washington and Tel Aviv.
We're here to demand freedom for both George Abdullah and for Palestine. Pro-Palestinian activists in France are fed up with the state's repression of our message, their support for Israel, and the lack of justice for our hero Abdullah.
Abdullah is described as a model prisoner and maintains a vast correspondence with groups supporting anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics. Many believe Abdullah, a former school teacher and Maronite Christian, is exactly the type of unifying and heroic figure who could unite a fragmented and troubled Lebanese nation.
The reason of George Abdullah being arrested, not only because of his support to Palestine and his struggle, but because they are afraid of this icon, Arab and internationalist icon who influenced the left movement around the world.
No French media were at the demonstration for Abdullah. Despite the apparent Western media blackout, his supporters worldwide say they will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. This week, the British government approved the extradition to the United States of another famous political prisoner of the West, Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, demonstrations were held in more than 20 Italian cities as socioeconomic conditions in the country worsened by the day. 2 years of stringent restrictions to counter the COVID pandemic and the waves of sanctions against Russia that have followed Moscow's military operation in Ukraine are dragging Italy into its deepest recession since World War II. In Rome, thousands gathered in People's Square for a rally called by Italy's major trade union, CGL. The unionists called on the government to improve the country's employment situation, put an end to socioeconomic inequalities, and adopt measures to counter growing inflation and the ongoing energy crisis.
It is not acceptable that we are not consulted by the government when they introduce important provisions. A growing number of people cannot make ends meet, and extraordinary measures are needed. We must have our say.
Also on Saturday, a string of left-leaning pro-sovereignty movements staged anti-government protests in 22 cities, including Rome, Genoa, Trieste and Cagliari. In the Italian capital, over 1,000 people protested against arms supplies to Ukraine and the adoption of sanctions against Russia, which they say are only damaging Italy and the Italians.
There is a major difference between what the Italians think about the Ukraine war and the way the economy should be run and what the government and the parliament do. Finally, on Tuesday, for the first time since the start of the war, Prime Minister Draghi will address the parliament. Draghi has so far done everything he wanted.
There has been talk of a possible government crisis after Mario Draghi addresses the Senate on June 21st. A growing number of lawmakers complained that no debate has so far been held on crucial issues, including how anti-Russia sanctions can affect Italy.
High inflation, rising costs of energy, high levels of unemployment, all Italy's socioeconomic indicators are headed downwards. In addition to that, the wealthy northern Italy has been hit by an unprecedented drought, which is severely threatening water supplies and the agri-food sector, as the country is struggling to cope with years of negligence and bad policies. A hot autumn of strikes and protests is widely expected. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of businesses across the European Union are struggling to stay open due to unprecedented costs relating to energy and supplies. We spoke to one cafe owner in Brussels.
How is it possible to survive in business? Electricity, oil, gas, and buying in stock is crazy. Prices are crazy. If we do not get more support, we will go under.
Inflation is through the roof. Poverty is on the rise. EU finance ministers have been told there needs to be a more coordinated response.
We continue to support our economies, but not in a universal way, as we did during the COVID crisis, in a more targeted way.
Most EU nations are also members of NATO. An EU army is being developed. Social inequality is a growing problem, but there is no end of money for lethal weapons.
An enormous amount of equipment, ammunition, weapons have already arrived in Ukraine. But of course there are bottlenecks, there are challenges, and there also are some requirements, for instance, for training, for spare parts, to be delivered together with the specific weapons.
Even Pope Francis says the war in Ukraine was provoked or not prevented by the West. Last September, an EU agency outlined the incredible scale of corruption in Ukraine. Despite this, Kiev looks poised to join the 27-nation bloc.
Yes, Ukraine deserves European perspective. Yes, Ukraine should be welcomed as a candidate country.
Economists say sanctions against Russia are going to push up prices in the EU even more.
And some suggest Euroscepticism is going to rise like never before, resulting in the EU project crumbling by the year 2030. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of people came from across the UK Saturday to protest outside Parliament. Trade union leaders have joined frontline workers and community organisations to call for higher wages and support. The government says there is just so much it can do, though, blaming the situation on a global energy crisis and the conflict in Ukraine. In a long-winded address, the Chancellor of the Exchequer promised a payout to ease energy bills, but it's too little, too late.
The cost of living crisis here in the UK is real. Everything from food, fuel to rent has gone up in price. And that means people across the country are having to tighten their belts. And that in turn means fewer donations to food banks and more mental health challenges.
Food banks say the number of people turning up has increased massively. And the kind of people turning up has most definitely changed. People in full-time work and key workers. Even with both adults working, households are struggling to make ends meet.
My daughter, Jess, she's a nurse, and she had to borrow money off me to pay for the car to get to work. And it's an intolerable position that the NHS staff and all workers across the country with the inflation, interest rates going up, cost of living, and we've had enough of it.
The government says it cannot completely mitigate the effects of the crisis. The Trades Union Congress, however, says while real wages across the economy are down by £68 a month compared to a year ago, bonuses for city executives has risen exponentially. So money is not reaching those who need it most, and until quite recently, were hailed as heroes.
Our postal workers that worked through COVID, that kept the country going, that were in fear of their own life for the people back home, but they stepped up to the plate, they worked through it all, and they deserve a better pay deal. So we're here with these unions to say to the government, pay our people. You clapped us, now pay us.
Although these are hard times, people at today's protest slammed the Tory government's immigration policies as well.
The thing is, they've had to come in illegally because we've closed all the quarters for us to come in legally and then just deporting them out of the country to Rwanda. It's disgraceful, particularly when this government not so long ago imposed sanctions on Rwanda because of the human rights atrocities. So there you go, that's my point.
War and famine and climate change are creating terrible situations across the world, and we want to make that better. But whilst people are trying to get away from that and seek refuge and seek asylum in our country and other countries in Europe, they should be welcomed. They should be given safe passages and they should be welcome here.
The price hikes are the worst in half a century and taken off guard many Britons, 15% of which were already food insecure, are now having to choose between heating their homes and eating. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Cheongwon-dae, South Korea's Blue House, is now open to the public. The presidential office has moved, with the former grounds becoming a park and popular attraction. The move was finalized just weeks before incoming President Yoon Suk-yeol's inauguration. The new office is in South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, adjacent to a U.S. military base, with the government this week opening a park there on a 10-day trial. President Yoon moved the presidential office to leave behind what he called the era or symbol of imperial power and get closer to the people. It's been suggested that visitors to this park will be able to see the president working in his fifth-floor office. Just one problem. The park is polluted with toxins in the soil and groundwater many times the levels otherwise considered safe. An environmental catastrophe a long time in the making, say activists.
These facilities have never been restored from their use by the Japanese Army and then the U.S. Army.
You can find the boiler tubes and pipelines, which have decayed underground, leaking oil, resulting in the gradual accumulated contamination of the soil, not just from 1 or 2 years, but over decades.
The U.S. base is in the process of returning to South Korean control. According to government surveys, benzene, xylene, and other hydrocarbons, as well as arsenic and cancer-causing dioxins, have been detected at harmful levels in more than 60% of the area.
After the entire U.S. base is returned, they should execute a detailed investigation into how contaminated it is and establish a plan to clean up the pollution. And after the cleanup is carried out and verified, then the park can finally be built. According to the original government plan, it'll take about 7 years.
The Yoon administration plans to open the park fully in September and feature an American-themed culture zone, or Little L.A. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Scads of emails to FIFA and no answers yet. Following the Canadian national soccer team's pullout from a planned match with Iran, pressures have been heaping on Canada's footballing body, Canada Soccer, for what Iranian sports authorities regard as unsportsmanlike and illegal. They have been trying different ways to reach FIFA for answers, but to no avail.
In several attempts, I tried to contact FIFA to ask for an interview with its chief executive officer, but there was no response. I also emailed their media department, but so far we have received no answer.
The Iran match was due to take place on June 5th in Vancouver as a preparatory friendly in the lead-up to the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. But 9 days ahead of the game, Canada Soccer canceled the fixture, citing untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran. The exhibition match was called off days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized Canada Soccer for its decision to host Iran.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with the sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Days later, Team Canada set another match with Panama to replace the Iran contest. But to everyone's surprise, that game too was called off at the 11th hour. This time, Canada Soccer cited payment disputes raised by the Canadian players as the reason why the Panama match was cancelled. To Iran's sports ministry, Canada's flip-flopping is against the FIFA regulations and deserves punishment.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
The Iran match was a golden chance for the 38th-ranked Canadian men to test their performance against a team that ranks 21st in the world. Now with the World Cup looming, and just 4 years prior to serving as co-host of the 2026 Men's World Cup, Canada Soccer has embroiled itself in a crisis that has the potential of leaving indelible scars on Canada's sport and its image in the world. 3 weeks after Canada Soccer's controversial move, the backlash is yet to subside. Iran says it's seriously following up on its legal pursuit to seek damages, and that has raised speculations about the possibility of the case being taken to the Court of Arbitration for Sports, known as CAS. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Humanitarian aid being loaded into a lorry. I'm heading with pro-Russian volunteers to a village near the front line, which is constantly under shelling in order to deliver much-needed supplies. Despite the destruction all around, incredibly, people still live here. We stop off next to the final checkpoint. Beyond is no man's land, the grey zone between the opposing armies. Artillery can be heard. It's unclear whether it's Russian or Ukrainian.
Now it is from both sides. Artillery duels. And we're in the middle. The shells are flying over our heads. And they might fall here. So let's just gradually move away.
Pieces of shrapnel like this are supposed to hit us. This one is small. They're bigger ones. Look how sharp it is. They cut through flesh like a sieve. These are Ukrainian gifts to our children. They're different shapes and sizes. You could keep it as a souvenir from Donbass.
Unexpectedly in this wasteland, a bus pulls up. The man tells me his house was destroyed yesterday. He shows me his wounds. I asked him why he's come back. To get some documents and feed his cat, he says. A crowd is gathered at the drop-off point, hungry for the humanitarian aid.
There was that video showing a woman from Western Ukraine sitting on the road embracing her two children and asking, how could it be so that her house was destroyed by Russian shelling? She should ask the woman whose three children died in a bathroom from Ukrainian shelling how she felt. I also have children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I want to live in peace here in Donbas, not watch all this going on.
It's noticeable here that most people are women and children. The men have joined the armies.
Now, the front line is only a few hundred meters away. There's a lot of emotion here, understandably, about this war. Some people here even tell me they have cousins who are fighting in the Ukrainian army, while their sons and husbands are fighting for the pro-Russians. This war has divided the country. It's also divided villages like this.
My son died on the 3rd of November. He'd been on the front line for 8 years. He went there in 2014 as a volunteer, and now he's dead. What for, I ask, what for?
Those who remain don't leave because it's their home, and they have nowhere else to go. They tell me this used to be a pleasant place to live. The same can be said of many other parts of Ukraine. The longer this war goes on, the more of this pleasant land will be destroyed. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Ahead of a planned visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, Israeli media revealed that the American administration had raised the possibility of holding a meeting between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, but the Palestinians have rejected the idea. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Palestinians informed the Americans that they would only accept such a meeting if all parties agreed on advancing a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders.
The Biden administration, with its offer to have a kind of a meeting between the Palestinians and the Israelis, is trying just to get out of the hawk. It's trying to say that they are interested in doing something in the area. At the same time, what they are offering is just a kind of a arrangements, economic arrangements, to make life a little bit much better under the occupation. Now, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians in general are aiming at ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
The Palestinians, however, want from the Americans to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Al-Quds and to remove the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from the U.S. terror list. These demands had been made during a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf in Ramallah.
Biden's visit carries with it many risks, including shaping the situation in the region in favor of U.S. interests and those of Israel. We have demanded from the U.S. some issues that it can make unilaterally and don't require hollow meetings. It's clear the U.S. will be ignoring the major cause, which is the Palestinian cause.
On Tuesday, the White House confirmed Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask the milk producers in Northern Ireland, how he or she can produce the milk one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently, just 15% of UK exports go to the US. And according to analysts, it would take years for London and Washington to agree on a new trade deal. EU leaders simply do not trust the British government any longer. Analysts have been surprised by the bloc's unity throughout the Brexit process after the EU spelled out its red lines.
And the EU has been very consistent in keeping to those red lines, probably more unified than anyone expected. Whereas on the other side, we have seen huge divisions.
This protocol presents for Northern Ireland.
It's been suggested, for political reasons, Johnson cannot back down now, and therefore it would ultimately require a change of government in London to avoid a trade war. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
New scientific research published recently shows the waters in the North Barents Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Coyley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Off the Scale, Warmer Arctic Ocean Fueling Climate Feedback Loop Faster Than Previously Known. Here's more. New scientific research published recently shows the waters in North Barents Sea are warming at a rate that is much more rapid than most climate models have predicted, with worrying implications about feedback loops for the larger Arctic region and far beyond. Extending between the north coast of Norway and Russia in the eastern Arctic Ocean, the North Barents Sea has been warming at a rate nearly 7 times that of the global average, this study shows. The researchers used temperature data over 4 decades to determine that the trends in the region, the fastest warming place known on Earth, should be seen as an early warning of what could happen elsewhere. Published in Scientific Reports, the new findings offer further confirmation that feedback loops in the Arctic are taking hold, but could be doing so at a faster rate than previously understood. The warming pattern is primarily consistent with reductions in sea ice cover and confirms the general, spatial, and temporal patterns represented by reanalysis, states the abstract of the study, adding, however, our findings suggest even a stronger rate of warming and sea ice concentration and sea surface temperature relation than was known in this region until now. Researchers behind this study reports High North News warn the increased warming is likely to fuel increases in extreme weather in North America, Europe, and Asia. The scientists say the Barents Sea region offers a window into how warming is already impacting the Arctic more broadly and what more rapid warming can look like elsewhere in the future. We expected to see strong warming, but not on the scale we found. Ketil Isaken, a senior researcher at the Norwegian Meteorological Institute who led the study, told The Guardian. "We were all surprised," he added. "We were surprised from what we know from all other observation points on the globe. These are the highest warming rates we have observed so far,"